They've still got a ways to go before they really have a threat to the United States.
Assessing North Korea's true missile capabilities. It's Thursday, July 6th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Thailand's migrant worker problem. The U.S. sails again in the South China Sea. Western doctors to see ailing Nobel laureate. Technology to combat domestic abuse. A school for tech startups. We start up right now with VOA Asia. As the UN Security Council is once again discussing a North Korean missile test, leader Kim Jong-un said Wednesday Pyongyang will not place its nuclear or its missile program on the negotiating table. Quoting Kim, this KRT newsreader said the North will not flinch even one inch from the road to bolster its nuclear force unless the U.S. hostile policy and nuclear threat to North Korea are terminated. On Tuesday, the North said it successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile, an assessment shared by South Korea and the U.S. state-run media, which described Kim as feasting his eyes on the ICBM and said it is capable of carrying a large nuclear warhead. Kim is quoted as urging his scientists to send a big and small gift package to the Yankees. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the test a new escalation of the threat to the United States and called for action to halt a global threat. U.S. and South Korean forces Wednesday fired off deep strike precision missiles into South Korean territorial waters as a show of force. The Hwasong-14 missile was assessed to have reached an altitude of about 2,800 kilometers and a distance of 900 kilometers before falling into the Sea of Japan. Some experts said the missile is capable of reaching Alaska, but RAND Corporation defense analyst Bruce Bennett is cautious about the true extent of the North Korean threat.
We do have to remember, though, that this missile only had about a 6,500-kilometer range from what people are estimating, which would allow them to reach parts of Alaska, but certainly not to either Hawaii or the continental United States. So they've still got a ways to go before they really have a threat to the United States other than in Alaska.
Well, what about the speed with which they are testing? Are you surprised that the advancement is coming so quickly?
It is a little surprising, but not entirely. I mean, we usually assume that North Korea is doing this all by themselves, that they're not getting any foreign help. And yet I think there's every reason to believe that they probably have some scientists from perhaps Russia, perhaps China, who have worked on developing this kind of missile and are providing information on what a warhead looks like and how it gets through the atmosphere. So I think it's not at all surprising that they've made these advances.
One analyst, Patrick Cronin, an Asia expert with the Center for New American Security, said President Trump is probably, quote, coming to the point of no return with North Korea, adding the upshot could be diplomatic overtures or military action. Where are we in this process?
Don't know for sure because President Trump hasn't said, but let's face it. You have to ask, are we better letting North Korea develop hundreds of nuclear weapons and threatening South Korea with those and telling South Korea to surrender to North Korea for it to take over South Korea? Do we really want to wait for that, or do we want to confront North Korea sooner? It's a hard trade-off, but we may have to face a military confrontation that leads to war sooner or later, and it's probably better if it's sooner because of the growing threat.
Do you anticipate Trump administration will have to revise its policy toward North Korea?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration is going to have to now give North Korea a choice. They can choose to stop this behavior, or the U.S. is going to start turning, I would think, to various forms of seeking for the regime to change. So far, the United States has been clear that we were not going to push for regime change. But North Korea is putting the United States in a very difficult position where we may have to consider that alternative. That's been very foolish of North Korea to do that.
China's foreign ministry on Wednesday urged North Korea not to violate UN Security Council resolutions. A spokesman also called for calm and restraint. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. North Korean leader openly boasts of successful ICBM test. Trump attacks China's growing trade with North Korea. Japan and EU reach a political agreement on trade deal. Bangladesh accuses 13 of negligence, murder over garment plant blast. Israel and India sign several agreements during Modi's visit. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, and there's a lot more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Thailand's military government has been forced to set a six-month grace period for new migrant labor laws with harsh penalties after protests and panic among workers and employers. Migrant labor has a crucial place in the Thai economy, with up to 2.7 million workers from neighboring Myanmar, Laos, and Cambodia working in fisheries, construction, agriculture, and processing. But a June 23rd government decree came with little prior public consultation with workers, trade unions, or employers, and that led to a rush by workers back to their home countries and crowded bus stations and border checkpoints. The decree is part of Thai efforts to control unregulated labor in the country, and it set harsh penalties, including prison terms and penalties on undocumented workers of up to $2,700. A minimum wage for migrant worker is about $200 a month. Employers were also targeted with fines of more than $23,000 for each illegal worker found on their premises. Thai labor rights groups and Sinapan Semidorai, a conveyor for Singapore-based ASEAN Migrant Workers Task Force, said more than 100,000 migrant workers have left Thailand since June 23rd.
The whole attention is not about preventing, but punishing the workers who are employed in undocumented or those who don't have the cards and permits from the proper officers. I think that led to a sort of a scrambling of workers returning back to Cambodia, Myanmar, returning back in large numbers, and that was a panicky situation.
Thai Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha announced a 180-day grace period through the use of a special executive decree to delay the introduction of the labor law. Pantain Watanangorn, an advisor to Deputy Prime Minister Prawit Wongsunwan, said positive elements of the decree included protecting migrant worker and employers' rights, but they were very strict punishment for violations. Panatan said implementation of the law was key, and relevant government agencies were being called on to provide solutions during the six-month transition period.
The implementation of it has to be coordinated between different ministries, between the labor, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and Ministry of Interior. And lastly, in the interim period, transitional period, there will be impacts on the implementation of the new law.
The business sector has been hard hit by the decree. In Cambodia, officials shut down more than 40 border crossings into Thailand, arguing it was to prevent Cambodians from entering Thailand and facing punishment. Thai farmers who routinely pick up Cambodian day laborers on the border were forced to leave empty-handed after the gates were closed. Buntai Chilert, the president of the Chiang Mai Tourism Business Association, said the laws created problems for small businesses, including tourism in the northern provinces. His main concern is the workers will not return.
They go out, they go back to Myanmar or to Cambodia, to Laos. They don't come back again because in Myanmar or Laos or Cambodia, they are country. They have a practice in Thailand, they go back. And I think the policy of the Thai government is very, very mistake.
Thailand has been working with the United Nations International Labor Organization to create formal registrations for migrant workers with labor agreements with Cambodia, Myanmar, and Laos. But Nilam Baruha, a senior ILO research specialist, says while parts of the law were welcomed, a drawback was a lack of consultation.
The problem is that there was, no consultation on the final draft law, or even with employers, with trade unions, with CSOs, or even with the ILO. There was, it would have been much better to have a consultation, a public hearing that they are planning to do now.
He called for a review of the high penalty rates and prison terms and an easing of restrictions on migrant labor mobility. But labor rights activists say concerns remain that the law will open the way for official corruption by local officials. Ron Corbin in Bangkok has our thanks for filing this story. Happening now in Asia, at least 5 were killed and 89 injured in a gas pipeline explosion in northeastern China. State media reported Wednesday it was the second deadly incident of its kind this week. At least 8 people were killed in the earlier mishap in southwest China. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're spending part of your day with us on VOA Asia. A second U.S. naval mission to the disputed South China Sea over the past 6 weeks indicates President Donald Trump is increasing pressure on Beijing after a wait-and-see period, a windfall for Chinese maritime rivals in Southeast Asia. Analysts say China has become the dominant force in the sea in the past decade, and it's expected to answer U.S. moves by increasing economic ties with Southeast Asian countries that dispute Beijing's maritime expansion. Andrew Young is the Secretary General with the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies think tank in Taiwan. He says freedom of navigation maneuvers will continue. Trump had sidelined the maritime matter since April while seeking China's help in squelching North Korea's missile program. But Young says he may not have gotten what he expected.
Holding back the freedom of navigation operation is trying to encourage China to do more about the nuclear crisis in North Korea. So this will be continue one of the bargaining positions in the future.
The USS Stethem guided missile destroyer passed Sunday within 12 nautical miles of Triton Island, a Chinese holding in the South China Sea's Paracel Islands. Vietnam claims the Paracels and disputes China's control over the archipelago in a sea that's prized for fish, oil, and natural gas. The United States does not have a claim in the sea. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and the Philippines do contest China's claims. Termsak Chalampalampop, a political security affairs fellow with the ISEAS Yusuf Ishak Institute in Singapore, says China is used to U.S. forays and knows what to expect.
It's just becoming routine. They know the procedure, what to expect. And in the meantime, I think the Chinese are making progress in winning hearts and minds on the continental Southeast Asia.
Since a World Arbitration Court ruled last year that the legal basis for China's maritime claim was invalid, Beijing has been privately working out details with the Southeast Asian claimants who the same ruling favored. In May, China and the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations agreed to the outline for a code of conduct aimed at heading off accidents at sea. China has separately tapped its $11.2 trillion economy to offer individual claimants investment, tourism, income, and development aid. Song Seng-woon, economist in the private banking unit CIMB in Singapore, says those offers have reached a huge amount as China extends development aid in the name of its 4-year-old Belt and Road Initiative that calls for extending Chinese investment as far as Eastern Europe.
That will always be under the Belt and Road banner. So perhaps it's also the case that investment will continue to grow. So investment push by the Chinese will be concurrent with, I think, what's happening on the political side.
The analysts agree the Southeast Asian nation maritime claimants will still welcome the U.S. government's refocus on the South China Sea as a challenge to the Chinese claim. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for sending us this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens.
Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news alert from VOA Asia. At least one person has been killed in floods in western Japan after heavy rain fell overnight on Tuesday. The heavy downpour caused an evacuation order of some 20,000 people in the region. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. It appears that prominent Chinese dissident and Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo will be allowed access to American and German medical expertise following his medical parole to a northern Chinese hospital after he was diagnosed with what authorities called advanced liver cancer. Liu is currently serving an 11-year prison term for inciting subversion of state power after co-authoring a pro-democracy petition called Charter 08. People close to Liu and his wife, Liu Xia, have said that the couple wants to seek medical help abroad. Human Rights Watch researcher Maya Wong tells VOA that she does not see this as a concession by Chinese authorities, who continue to deny Liu the chance to seek treatment elsewhere and continue to hold him under heavy guard at a hospital in the northeast city of Shenyang.
This is looking more like a way for the Chinese government to ease some of the pressure it feels from the international community to free Liu Xiaobo rather than stepping down in any way from the Chinese government. That the intention is to hope that it doesn't want any more attention, particularly as the G20 summit is coming up in Hamburg, Germany.
Wong says there was some surprise that upon his arrival, new U.S. ambassador to China and former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad called for Liu Xiaobo to have the freedom of medical treatment.
Perhaps it is a bit surprising, I mean, given the fact that he had branded himself as kind of a good personal friend of Xi Jinping, and all the indications suggested that under the Trump administration that the U.S. doesn't seem to be very interested in pressing China on human rights issues. But I think it is positive that he started by, you know, mentioning Liu Xiaobo and asking the Chinese government to free him for treatment abroad. Now we just need to see how this is going to actually pan out, as in would the U.S. government actually put enough actual pressure on the Chinese government to free Liu Xiaobo. We want to see collective action by governments around the G20 to make sure that China lets Liu Xiaobo go.
The G20 summit is a very high-profile meeting of world leaders at which President Donald Trump will be holding bilateral meetings on the sidelines amid the timing of comments on Liu Xiaobo's treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is the Chinese government trying to ease some of this international pressure that it anticipates around the G20. But I think this should also be an indication to foreign governments that the Chinese government continues to be sensitive to international pressure. And what these governments need to do around G20 is to double their efforts on this case to ensure that Liu Xiaobo is let go.
Maya Wong said the case of Liu Xiaobo is one of the most visible and serious rights violations by the Chinese government since the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. The state-run Global Times said the foreign physicians allowed in will be consulting with a team of Chinese doctors already assigned to the case, and quotes Liu's wife as saying the hospital has done its best to treat her husband and has agreed to use traditional Chinese medicine. Developing at this hour in Asia, Hanoi residents on Wednesday say they disagree with a government plan to ban motorcycles from the Vietnamese capital. Officials in the traffic-choked capital have vowed to banish motorbikes by 2030 to ease environment and congestion woes. VOA Asia Facebook is your road to the latest stories and features every day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, as technology has become a part of our daily life, it's increasingly being used to intimidate victims of domestic violence. In Australia, an organization is helping victims discover smart devices abusers might be using to invade their privacy and control them from afar. VOA's Faith Lapidus narrates this story by Faiza El-Masri.
Using technology to abuse or harass has become very common, according to Alex Richmond, community education officer at a women's shelter in Australia.
In terms of clients we've seen at the refuge in the last 12 months, the stat would be 95%.
Last year, she says, staff at the shelter found GPS trackers hidden in children's toys, as well as endless streams of abusive text messages to women via their smartphones or on Facebook. Spyware is often installed to monitor phone use, as well as a person's movements.
It is very much the new frontier of domestic violence, and we're seeing terrible abuse in that realm.
Domestic violence victims are encouraged to take steps to prevent abuse. That includes changing phones or seeking help to debug the technology and devices around them.
Hello, Tracy.
Desmond Campbell works for Safe at Home, an organization that makes victims feel in control of their own lives. During his home visits, he makes sure his clients' houses are secure, checking every lock and all the entry points to the property, windows and doors inside. His job is to make sure the woman who lives here is safe, but he knows that physical safety is just part of an overall security strategy that also takes into account his clients' online presence.
When I talk about this debugging training that's coming up, a lot of them are still very interested in getting that extra service. And it's just an extra way of making them, well, allowing them to be safe and feel safe in their homes.
And that includes feeling safe when they go online. For writer Faisal Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
People from all over the world come to Silicon Valley to learn about tech startups and how to become successful entrepreneurs. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports from Mountain View, California, about a new program called Startup School. It delivers those vital startup lessons to tech company founders without leaving their hometowns.
Y Combinator is a Silicon Valley firm that has helped fund the launch of some of the world's most valuable and well-known tech companies. Entrepreneurs around the world compete to be part of its twice-yearly 10-week program. Only 2% of applicants are accepted. Expanding its reach, Y Combinator has now put its program online. More than 7,000 tech founders from 140 countries signed up for the first Startup School.
Hi, my name is Kai, and I'm building a company called Bhakti.
I'm the CEO of Biopen Energy Company.
Hey! We're Tap 2,
a Spotify for transportation.
Classes are taught by tech luminaries who have started firms such as Facebook, Slack, and others.
The most successful startups are not derivatives. They are not a copy of something else that was working pretty well.
Mentors hold weekly office hours with the founders, both online and in person. Stephen Pham helps to run Startup School.
Internet access has only been something that people had access to very recently in a lot of these markets. And in a lot of these communities where startups are super, super early, we wanted to be able to get in there and help them learn best practices in starting companies.
Startup School culminates with presentation day. Hundreds of companies from around the world pitch their ideas online, even from war-torn Syria, where one group is teaching children how to create circuits. Others are applying technology to fields such as transportation, travel, and education. Socialize is based in Sudan, trying to help the blind engage on social media more easily.
See how it works from a blind person's view.
People sort of just have this idea. Silicon Valley is where the startups are at, and it's really cool for me to see so many diverse companies from so many places around the world.
In Startup School, we made a bunch of friends from the online chat. We're probably going to continue those friendships and with other founders.
There may not be a Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg in this batch of Startup School graduates.
So Like Me is the Tinder for friends.
You must be wondering, what does this kid know about cybersecurity?
But tapping into this global tech community may be what keeps them going long after the pitching is over. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Mountain View, California.
We're glad you've been listening to VOA Asia, and we always tap into our tech community. Director Tracy Carter, engineer Keith Holmes, providing us with all we need to put our program on the air every day. We also like to say hello to everybody listening at DZUP, 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman. Thank you so much for joining us today. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team includes Ali Ogden and David Byrd. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.